this week on Life and Faith.
And I think in Parker's case, I think creativity was a burden. I genuinely think she didn't know what to do with it. She had these great outlets, you know, helping start the New Yorker magazine, writing for Vanity Fair and Vogue, writing poetry, being a theater critic, but nothing fed her soul. And so it was a sad existence. She attempted suicide 3 or 4 times and wrote a poem on suicide and said it at a party with F. Scott Fitzgerald. And, you know, what a conversation killer, no pun intended.
We're scoring about 5% in our test of what's the universe made of.
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth.
What kind of country is it that we live in when you can't tell a child why his father was killed because you didn't want him to grow up hating white people?
Does the human race deserve to continue?
This is Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart. Now, I don't know how often you might have this experience, but you come across the story of someone, might be a writer or a figure from history, and you think, how come I've never heard of this person? They sound amazing. Well, Joe Kadlicek has found 3 of them, and they're all called Dorothy. You might have heard of one or another of them, but all 3 were working at the same time from the 1920s onwards, and they were trailblazing women writers, enormously talented, unconventional in their lives and in their loves, and I have to say they're unjustly forgotten today. Well, Joe has been a journalist and a novelist and a teacher, among other things. She's been doing that for years, but she's just seen her first play performed at this year's Sydney Fringe Festival. It's called Speak Easy, and it brings together these 3 Dorothys, Dorothy L. Sayers, Dorothy Parker, and Dorothy Day. Natasha Moore went along to the play and also spoke to Joe about why she's been trying for so long to get these 3 very different women in a room to talk to each other. Natasha has this conversation for you with a few snippets from the performance to bring the Dorothys to life. I should say at the beginning that while there's nothing graphic here, there are adult themes, so you might want to show some discretion in terms of who's listening with you.
I'm Joe Kadlicek. I am the playwright, which is a little crazy to even say, of Speak Easy, which I had been thinking about for about, 15 years or so.
Oh, is that
so.
All?
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yep, and researching and reading about, and finally, because I received a fellowship, a summer fellowship with Anglican Deaconess Ministries, I actually got to start it. So I feel like their voices have been in my head, and I've, for that, you know, probably 15, 20 years. And I worked at a college in the U.S. for a while and had a great theater department, so was always talking to my theater colleagues, you know, these 3 Dorothys, they should have a conversation on stage. Yes, Joe, they should. You should get to that. So when I finally got the fellowship from ADM and was kind of forced the issue, it was such a buzz because it was as if the voices in my head from each Dorothy finally got out and were in the same room, so to speak, on the same page.
There is a 4th Dorothy in the play. Tell me about her, and was it always going to be about her? How are you going to bring these 3 Dorothys together?
Well, that's why one of the primary reasons I think I've avoided it for so long, because I wasn't sure how to bring them together. How do you bring in these legendary writers, 2 of whom were born the same year in 1893, Sayers and Parker, and Day was born only 4 years later, but they all came into their own in the 1920s as women writers making a living, which is so unusual. And that's why, I thought, how do you get them on stage when in real life they never met? They did probably read each other's work. In fact, Dorothy Day's bookshelves were lined with Dorothy Sayers' mysteries.
Oh, really?
Which is really interesting to me, yes. And Parker and Day lived in the same city, so I know they knew of each other. But how was I going to get them on stage without it being, you know, contrived or unbelievable. And the only way I could figure out how to do that was through the lens of another writer. So the other Dorothy is a fictitious writer who, like all of us as writers, can't figure out our own voice until we've read a lot of other voices. So it's really taking her journey, Dorothy's journey, Dorothy Jemima, or DJ, because she doesn't know why she's named Dorothy. So she's pregnant, she's on a deadline, and she's still reeling from the death of her mother when her husband surprises her with these three boxes that have Dorothy written on the side. And he's found them in as they were cleaning out her mother's home. And they assume that they're old works of hers, but with each one that she opens, she discovers one of these other Dorothys. And then she can't understand why her mother would have left them for her. So that's the journey that she has to go on.
Let's talk about each of the Dorothys. Okay. I want to start with Dorothy Sayers, partly because she's the one that I know the best and I really like her.
Good.
Do you have a sense of why she's not better known? I think she's great.
Agreed. And she's Dorothy L. Sayers, as you'll remember. Mm. That's a line in the play. that's another line in the play. Nobody ever remembers women writers. Mm. And in Christian circles, people are more likely to remember her male counterparts at the time, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien. Although, Dorothy L. Sayers really held her own and actually challenged Lewis on his theology a couple times. So why isn't she better known? I don't know. I mean, I think her fiction, detective fiction is one thing. There's a Dorothy L. Sayers Society. Mm-hmm. There's a Lord Peter Wimsey Society. So she still has fans without question. But her essays on culture and Christianity are fascinating and I go back to them regularly, because I feel like they help you understand so much of the creative process through a Christian lens. Her book, The Mind of the Maker, is a theology of creativity, using the Trinity as a metaphor for the process of creativity, of any kind of creative act. So it could be that she was in too many different genres, and that is problematic for agents. They're not sure quite what to do with this woman who wrote advertising copy, detective fiction, pop culture, essays, radio dramas, and then translated Dante. She's a force. She's got a hurricane of thought in her head, and that came out. I mean, there wasn't a time when she wasn't working, when she wasn't writing.
And the other thing is, the advantage of telling the truth is no one ever believes it.
No one ever believes the truth?
No. Said Lord Peter Wimsey, my resident sleuth.
In what sense would you say that Sayers was or wasn't a woman of her time?
What a great question. You know, when they came into their own in the 1920s, the whole world, Western world, was shifting. I think Sayers came onto the scene. She was a daughter of an Anglican minister, and that never left her, but she sure did question it in interesting ways. And so she honored them, but she also loved writing and decided that she was going to be an academic, so one of the first women to graduate from Oxford. And her father arranged for her to have different opportunities in publishing. And she, just because she was so creative, she wanted to honor the traditions of the time, the Christian and, spiritual traditions of the time. And that grew more and more in her journey. But I think she also didn't always know what to do with that.
I rarely know how I get anywhere. In fact, it would be a perfect little thing to put on my tombstone. Wherever she went, including here, it was against her better judgment.
First woman New York writer.
Dorothy Parker. To the extent that people know about or have read her, the thing that she's most known for, the one word that we kind of associate with Dorothy Parker, is wit.
Yes.
How do you get to be a person who that's your reputation, that you're witty?
Right. Well, you know, I think Dorothy Parker is such an interesting bird because she too has an international following. To this day, there's a Dorothy Parker Society. The Sydney Morning Herald ran a little section over the weekend in the Spectrum on the play. What did they include? A picture of Dorothy Parker. Not of the others. Mm. And not of the one we sent, but it was Dorothy Parker. And I think she grew up in a Jewish family in New Jersey, but was educated in Catholic schools. And because she knew real sorrow, her mother died young. Her father was really always busy, and he died in her early 20s. So she called herself an orphan. And I think because she knew such sorrow, deep sorrow, but didn't know how to deal with that, she used humor as a mask. She wrote all the time. I think it was accidental. People were, because there was not television in the 20s and radio was only just beginning to be a thing, people were writing little verses and sending them to the newspaper, and that was their kind of form of entertainment. Well, she saw her father doing that, and she decided she was going to do that. So one of the first ones that got accepted was the poem Women a Hate Song, you know. Whereas one of her biographers says, she made quote unquote mashed potatoes of women. Yes. So I think that wit, though, that it came from a dark place. And I think in Parker's case, I think creativity was a burden. I genuinely think she didn't know what to do with it. She had these great outlets, you know, helping start the New Yorker magazine, writing for Vanity Fair and Vogue, writing poetry, being a theater critic. She had these great outlets, but nothing fed her soul. And so it's a sad existence. She attempted suicide 3 or 4 times and wrote a poem on suicide and said it at a party with F. Scott Fitzgerald. And, you know, what a conversation killer, no pun intended. The Algonquin is a hotel in New York City. In fact, it just recently celebrated the 100th anniversary of the Algonquin Roundtable meetings. It was a group of very, very irreverent writers who were just emerging in the literary scene. And Parker was a member of the Algonquin, and they would have lunch together. There were probably 10 to 15 writers who would meet every day at the Algonquin. But, you know, they were the lost generation. They were the ones who were saying, we're going to be the ones to create change and do whatever we want. And so they did. And to my amazement, Parker outlived most of them, even though they were all alcoholics, you know.
Including her?
Including her. And even though she attempted suicide 4 times, you know, she outlived them all. And here's the really, really interesting thing about Dorothy Parker. For all of her wit and people know her as this witty, great, funny writer who sort of avoided looking at the deeper issues, from what you can tell in her writing, at least. When she died, she left her entire estate to Martin Luther King Jr. for the civil rights movement.
Wow.
Now, I find that fascinating. It was the 60s. She died in 1967. And I just think, you know, she clearly had a sense of justice. She was blacklisted during the McCarthy era as well because, you know, the government thought she might have been a communist because she hung out with such a variety of irreverent souls that who knows. But I find that really interesting that there was that moment when she clearly had a conscience and wanted to do the right thing, just didn't always know how to do that.
Woman of her time?
Oh, absolutely. She was, I don't even think she was ahead of her time. I think she was her time, if that makes sense. I think because she was in New York City, because New York was going through so many changes, because she was a member of the Algonquin Roundtable, because she wrote for all these emerging magazines, she really helped craft the voice of that time. So, and, you know, mostly made a living writing. Not always. Mm-hmm. And there are moments when you read her biographies when you just really feel for her because she had no money. And there are pictures where she looks like she's a homeless woman who hasn't, you know, had a bath for days. And fascinating character, enormous talent. But I really do think it was a bit of a burden for her.
Mm. Dorothy Day. I think she's the one that, well, the one that I know least about. And I think that that's true for lots of people. She comes across in your play and in what I've read about her as quite intense. Tell me what she was on about.
Well, she grew up in a journalist home, so to speak. Her father was a sports reporter. And so she was a reader, you know, all of her life, and started writing for a socialist paper and covering a lot labor issues, housing issues. You know, New York City was a really interesting time in the 1920s because it had a whole emergence of immigrants. So there was poverty everywhere, but there were. You also saw the Harlem Renaissance happening when African Americans had their chance at actually expressing their voice in jazz, the birth of jazz, and on Broadway. But Dorothy Day, because she had such an alive soul, that she really, really wanted to see justice and mercy for every human she came across. And because of that, when she became a Catholic, and she became a Catholic through an intense love affair with an agnostic, she really is so fascinating. That part is amazing to me, because she literally said that their love was so intense, she didn't think it was possible, humanly possible, to experience it. So there had to be a love greater than them as humans. And that's what set her off on her spiritual journey. And she was living in Staten Island, just across from, you know, Manhattan in New York Harbor. And the only people around her, besides her very agnostic, kind of mean-spirited partner, he wouldn't marry her, were Catholic nuns. So when she got pregnant, he wanted her to abort. She refused. Then she decided to have the baby baptized, and the experience of having a child was quite spiritual for her as well. When she had the baby baptized, it caused a wedge in her relationship with her partner, but then even more so when she told him she was going to be baptized in the Catholic Church, and because he said, "If you do, I will leave," and so it became a choice of love for her.
Wow.
And so she went ahead and became baptized. He left. A few years later, the Depression hit, the stock market crashed, and the Catholic Worker Hospitality House was born. And she lived the rest of her life in Catholic Workers, advocating for the poor and homeless, offering a bowl of soup every night. I've been to the Catholic Worker in New York City. It still exists.
Now we've got a saint on our hands.
Saint? I don't want to be dismissed so easily.
The long, long...
And the irony, too, about Dorothy Day and her activism, because that's really, she just lived her faith, was that she used to cover women's rights, protests and marches for voting, and then was jailed and tortured in jail for doing that. And never voted in her life because she didn't believe in giving any kind of credence to the government. So never paid taxes, never voted, never had an income from the time that the Catholic Worker began until she died in 1980. She's now up for sainthood within the Catholic Church. She was quite the pacifist. She handcuffed herself to Times Square during World War II. to just protest that this is a war that where people are going to die, and didn't want to see any kind of conflict. But that's pretty radical, you know. She's the one, when people find out about Dorothy Day, who might not have a faith perspective, many in the cast, for instance, when they have discovered Dorothy Day, they find she's the one they seem to respect the most. And I think it's because she lived out her faith in such a radical, compassionate way in caring for those on the margins.
Would you call her a woman of her time?
I don't think she would call herself a woman of her time, because she never liked her times. And I think she was a woman of her time in the 20s, but when the Catholic Worker emerged and the Depression hit, she was always kind of countercultural. So not even kind of, she was really countercultural. And so I think she was always protesting the times, especially if there were injustices.
One important thread through the play is this question of motherhood. DJ, the main character, is about to have her first child. Was that kind of central for you? Was that, you know, did that come early or late in the process? What was that for?
Yeah, and pregnant as well as reeling from her mother's death and a lot of unresolved issues with her mother, you know, the mother-daughter angst thing. That's a mysterious question. I don't know if I have an answer. Mm-hmm. I think it was, you know, when you go to write a play with a clear agenda, my agenda was just getting these Dorothys on stage, right? I didn't know what the story was going to be that would get them there. But I realized the more I studied them, the thing that linked them was this sense of their own identities as mothers, and how that formed them as women as well. And so there's also a bit of I think there's some metaphorical things that happen, children, writing, process, you know, creativity, birthing new ideas, etc. So there's some metaphorical things that happen. But, you know, each woman in her most vulnerable state had to confront the loss of a child, you know. So Sayers became pregnant out of wedlock. Now, she's the daughter of an Anglican minister. This is not going to go well. And so she hid it. She was really ashamed. She hid it. She took herself away to a home, stayed there for, just told people she was ill, had the baby, asked her cousin to raise the baby, and left him there. And that child grew up thinking she was Cousin Dorothy, because she supported him financially with her writing. But her parents died not knowing they were grandparents. And that is always really sad to me. And this great paragon of the Christian virtue has this secret that kind of puts her off of the pedestal for a bit, if you will, to evangelicals who want to say that she's marvelous. Well, she's like all of us, you know. Dorothy Day had an abortion, and it was quite upsetting for her. And as a Catholic, she obviously could not come at that. So when she became pregnant, her partner wanted her to abort, and she said no because it had been too traumatic for her. So she had the baby, and it was actually that spiritual experience that really drove her to God and to her faith as a Catholic. And was she a great mother? Well, she raised her daughter amongst the homeless in community living, and often had either someone from the Catholic Worker or local nuns taking care of her as she was traveling. So that one's up for grabs. But and then Parker, I don't know how many abortions she had, because she was she was with so many men, and but it certainly fed into her own sense of self-worth or lack thereof. You know, there's a line in the play where Parker actually says after that the doctor confirmed for me I was wicked to the core, evil. I was sure I'd seen those tiny hands. And in the hospital, you know, I left the hospital, but it did not leave me. So she joked about that, as of course, you know, she had to get back to hiding with her humor. So her big joke about her abortions became, serves me right for putting all my eggs in one bastard. So you know, there's such a layered sorrow to that sentence. You laugh at it, but you go, oh, ouch. You know, there's a real pain that's come out of that as well. So, but, you know, she used her humor to hide a lot of things. So that was an interesting, I knew that we'd get to that point in the play, just because of their commonality. But when I realized what had to happen for DJ being pregnant, I did not see that coming. I was working on the ending, and I realized what had to happen, and I was a mess. So I did not see it coming. But you have to go with the story, so.
Yeah. Do you think that the three Dorothys would actually have gotten on had they met in real life?
Maybe. I think they would have been polite to one another. I think Sayers would have been genuinely intrigued by Parker and Day's activism. I think Day would have been a bit annoyed and judgmental of both, but would have given them her last shirt if she had to. And I think Parker would have probably said, let's drink. So let's have a whiskey. And would have, you know, explored some issues about writing with them. But Parker wasn't great with women. She loved being around men. So I think actually all three are sort of in that camp, which is why a conversation for them on a stage is really interesting to me.
Did you have a favorite Dorothy?
Yeah, Dorothy Parker, definitely my favorite.
Why?
I don't know. I think I could relate to her in a lot of ways. Very strong female character. Yeah.
Oh, I thought the play was fantastic. I actually had never heard of those three women writers, and now I want to go more. I mean, Dorothy Parker, I had heard of her really great quips, but the other two, I actually will go and find material, read up. That's great.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I thought it was original, totally unexpected. Thoroughly enjoyed it.
Did you have a favourite Dorothy?
Oh, yes. Parker.
Why?
Because I think I related to her.
Tell me, for the record, your name and your relationship to this play.
Nicholas Papadimitriou, the biggest name in showbiz, and I'm the director.
Did you have any history with the Dorothys before this?
Dorothy Sayer I knew little of. Dorothy Parker I've always loved, and I've got, you know, a number of her poetry books. I think she's pretty spectacular. And Dorothy Day I've actually fallen in love with now, because she seems to me the most kind of amazing, because she retained a lot of her kind of outrageous kind of original self, and then after she converted or found religion and faith, she still remained a very tough old broad, and she still was very pro-life, pro civil rights, pro the poor. You know, she kept all her old values, but kind of morphed them into a newer value. And I found that really fascinating, that she juggled both and remained herself, which I find quite interesting.
Do you have a favorite Dorothy?
Mm.
Is that like asking you to choose between your children?
Well, that's part of what happens in the play, isn't it? You know, she has to decide at one point, and then she says she can't. You know, I probably resonate the most with Sayers, with her nonfiction. I have found it's been the most helpful for me as a writer of faith. But I can, you know, I'm in awe of Parker's wit, and I'm perpetually challenged by the Catholic worker. How do I live out a sense of faith? How do I care for those on the margins? How do I best respond to those who are in need? So I find that they are mentors, all three, in very different ways. And, you know, we've my creative partner, Allison Chambers, who plays Parker in the play, and I have started a theater company, and it's called Joining the Dots Theater. Now, that has a double meaning. It is, in fact, because we want to bring people together. But obviously, we want every production to have a little bit of Parker's humor that calls for some good action that Day would do, but also requires some intellectual and maybe theological reflection as Sayers would do. So it's intentionally joining the dots because there is a double meaning.
This has been Life and Faith from the Center for Public Christianity. I'm Simon Smart, and Natasha Moore has been speaking with Joe Kadlicek. Joe wrote the play Speak Easy, which was performed at the 2019 Sydney Fringe Festival. If you ever get the chance to see it when it's next stage, do. In the meantime, if you want to find out more about Dorothy Sayers in particular, we've got a whole Life and Faith episode on her, an interview with Amy Orr Ewing from a couple of years back. You can find it on our website, publicchristianity.org. Next week. And today is the very last episode of 2019, so we thought we'd get into the end of year spirit and do some reflecting.
We wanted to give you a bit of a glimpse into some of the stories behind the stories that we bring on Life and Faith.
We're also going to talk about our most confronting interview, and each of us will mention our most memorable moments as well.
Now, there's another aspect of production that some of us find harder than others, don't we? The editing process. That's right, Natasha.
Okay.
Pointing fingers.
I am the worst at this. I am aware of it.
She says that it is surprisingly fulfilling. Now, if you're like me, you're kind of like, really?
Christianity increasing your pleasure and fun. Now, that would, I reckon, be a surprise to lots of people today.